I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show that gets under the skin of science in such a good way, as we invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions. There's an Isaac Asimov quote that is sort of vaguely related, but I'm not going to do it again because I've said it now, I think probably 30 times.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of episodes. If you want to hear it...
If you want to hear it, just go back and listen to the back catalogue. It's a good quote. We say something pithy off the back of it, but we do it the same every week, and I've had it.
No, I like that. Let's innovate.
Gonna leave it. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
Similarly, no dig at you not being a real doctor. I'm leaving that now.
Wow, we are moving into a new era.
It's a new era. What I will say is, I suppose you are the Robin to my Batman, the Rodney to my Del Boy.
Del Boy.
Yeah. I think that's actually unkind to both of us. So you might take that.
Yeah, I'm taking that. I think you're more the CRISPR to my Cas9.
Oh my God. You imagine having to spend time with you voluntarily.
You flag up what needs doing, and I'm the one who actually does it.
You know, I got it. I just didn't like it. It's incredibly geeky. Right, and I like geeky stuff, but that's too far for me.
Oh, okay.
So are you crowbarring in a, and I use the phrase advisedly, genetics joke, because we're doing genetics today?
Yes, we are. Yeah, obviously I did that. I'm a physicist. I wouldn't pull that out for any other reason, would I?
No, you had no idea what CRISPR was before we started researching
half an hour ago.
So what's the broad...
So, I mean, basically what we're going to talk about today is how far we're going to push gene editing. So,
oh, nice.
So we're sort of asking what's next in the world of genetics.
Yeah, so I guess the thing you immediately think of is designer babies.
Yeah.
How much would you pick about your own child? So I'll get you to answer.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't pick a lot of stuff, obviously, because, you know, if they've got my genetics, they've got such a good start in life.
Okay.
It's not really worth changing anything, is it?
Okay. it's a good answer. I don't think it's a true answer.
What about you? Are you sort of saying, right, I'll pick and choose this?
No, I think I'm good. Same reason.
Obviously, with you. A narcissist speaks.
Well, I don't know. It's the problem is that there are certain elements that you clearly would choose, and we do choose, and are able to choose increasingly. So, you know, genetic abnormalities and stuff. Like, if you could choose not to have those, you will.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And I don't think that's particularly...
I mean, like
I was going to say it's not particularly contentious. I think it is slightly contentious.
I mean,
but
I've
in
got
my
genetically
mind,
high cholesterol, like chronically high cholesterol because of my genes. And I guess I would probably want to edit that out. I mean, there's no point having that.
Of course, yeah.
There's no point keeping that. But what you don't know is what is the effect of editing that out? Does it have unknown sort of side effects? And so that's why I'd be slightly sort of wary of it.
Well, before we came into the studio today, we were just chatting briefly about the subjects we were covering. And my observation, which I think is correct about genetics, is it's really interesting, but it's also unbelievably complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so hard. And by that, I don't mean necessarily hard to understand, although it is also hard to understand. Just the system is so complex. So you're right, like one gene... I mean, well, the other thing is not much interesting stuff is controlled by one gene.
No, that's
most stuff
true.
Is going to be polygenic for starters. But even if it is one gene, so even if you could turn off your cholesterol gene, you don't absolutely know that that's not having an influence on, on some other feature.
No, and we're going to get into that.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's nothing you'd change about you at all.
Well,
what about the chronic height problem?
It's not a problem. It is a problem.
You've got a terrible back.
You're is too that to tall do with,
for your
no,
spine.
No, I'm not too tall for my spine, thank you. My spine is a piece of shit, but I don't know if that's genetic. I guess I would wonder about whether I'd want bigger testicles.
Really?
But I've got small testicles. Now, to me, that's actually not bad,
right?
Because they're very neat,
right?
They're
yeah.
very sort of compact.
Yeah, don't take a lot of caring for.
No, they sort of look after themselves. Whereas sometimes I'll look at a big old pair of nads, and I'm like, imagine having those swinging around. I mean, you know, it feels like it's causing problems. But I can see there probably are drawbacks. So maybe I would just go up to sort of average size testes.
Right. Okay. Was not expecting that.
Yeah, but that's what I'm giving you. Yeah. But functionally, as far as I'm aware, they're all good. So maybe I'm actually an improvement.
You're more efficient in terms of packaging.
Yeah.
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 Well, because the thing is, they are vulnerable.
Yeah.
And you don't really want to be taking a blow to them. And the smaller they are, and the more, as I say, neatly packaged, the less likely that is to happen.
Yeah, no.
You know, sometimes you'll see people when they cross their legs and they'll be like, ah!
Yeah,
they just cut that. That's never happening to me.
No, of course it isn't.
Never happening to me.
I'm glad you enjoy that.
According to Pfizer, humans share 96% of their DNA with chimpanzees, 60% with chickens, and most surprisingly, we share more than 60% of our DNA with bananas. As you might have guessed, genetics aren't straightforward, and we've been messing around with them for quite some time now. The possibilities of what we might be able to do in the future are exciting and ethically concerning in equal measure. And that's why this week we're asking, what will geneticists do next?
We have got Professor Matthew Cobb, a professor of zoology at the University of Manchester, the author of a new book called The Genetic Age, Our Perilous Quest to Edit Life, which is out now in the UK. It's out in the US in mid-November. It's got a slight title change in the States. It's As Gods, A Moral History of the Genetic Age.
Oh, lovely.
Which kind of tells you where Matthew's coming from, I think. So we're going to hear some pretty strong opinions in the next half hour or so.
Whereabouts on the timeline of the moral history of genetics are we going to start with?
So I'm going to let Matthew kick us off. And basically, he says we've been tinkering with life's blueprint for thousands of years already.
So humans are part of the ecosystem. We're predators. And so simply by being predators, and that includes not simply chasing animals, but also collecting berries and roots, we have shaped the animals and plants that we are interacting with. And that's just the way all life does that. So just, you know, we're going to try and use our intelligence to be dramatic, to hunt a mammoth or to pick a particular leaf. And by doing so, we're inadvertently changing the gene frequencies of the organisms that we're eating, because those organisms that we can't see, the berries that are slightly less visible to us, we don't eat. And so those characters are more likely to be passed on to the next generation. So we've been doing that from the very outset. And then with the development of agriculture, we started to deliberately breed particular kinds of animal or grow particular kinds of plant. And even we harnessed biotechnology without having the slightest idea what was going on. So we unwittingly, we discovered how to use microbes to make, for example, bread and beer. So we've been doing this from the very, very beginning. And there's a lot of argument amongst historians and people like that, that really there's no change. There's nothing different between what we do now, our ability to change single letters of DNA, to either this history of deliberately changing species through artificial selection, or further back, our role as natural agents of selection.
Hang on. Hang on a minute. I think there is quite a big difference between natural selection and changing single letters of DNA.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, to be clear, Matthew's not saying that there isn't. He's saying some historians are saying
it's just
a continuum.
Okay.
So, I mean, clearly...
They're wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Wrong. But so far, our expert isn't wrong, which is, I think, a new record now.
That's great. Did we ask him what he thinks of the octopus?
Survive the first clip unscathed. So, I mean, basically, there is a huge thing, isn't there? I mean, you know, doing those gradual changes, things that involve actually quite natural processes that have occurred through evolution anyway, and then... what we're doing, the technological approach now, is a completely different thing, I think. But let's sort of run through the kind of history of gene editing very quickly. So just breaking it down, so you've got 1953, Crick and Watson and Rosalind Franklin obviously, worked together didn't really work together, but, between them, managed to sort of give us the structure of DNA. DNA is made in the test tube for the first time, 1958. In 1962, we used jellyfish proteins to kind of observe these sort of invisible processes. So we started to be able to manipulate things. 67, we're linking DNA fragments together. So we're starting to, do something. So this is, all a long time ago. We discovered restriction enzymes in 1968. So that was basically from bacterial action, sort of discovering that, how they fight off potential predators effectively involves chopping down DNA. So, that was the sort of first clue that we might be able to do something with that. Then, you get into the 1970s and it all sort of kicks off and everyone gets a bit scared. Mm-hmm. So you get a few sort of moratoria where geneticists all agree that it's all going a bit too fast and we need to slow down everyone. So, you start to get this sense of like there might be ethical issues with this particular branch of science.
Think, I wonder who carried on. It's got to be, trust me, there's some people who carried on.
Yeah,
We don't need to dwell on that, but of course there are.
Then 1981, we got the first transgenic animal, which is a mouse genome that has a bit of rabbit gene in there. So that's the sort of first sort of, I guess what you might now call Frankenstein sort of approach.
Yeah.
That's the 80s.
How long did it live?
Of course, I mean, it probably never lived at all. It probably was just a sort of test tube thing.
Yeah.
I don't know the details on that. But then we start to see the positives, right? And this is where it starts to get difficult. So 1982, we've got the first genetically engineered human drug, which is synthetic insulin, which is a massive deal for, people with diabetes, obviously, because all of a sudden you're not dependent on, thousands and thousands of animals, with their pancreas glands producing insulin. So that's great. 1983, we've got the polymerase chain reaction. Carrie Mullis discovers it after training himself using LSD, but that's another story.
Legend.
Yeah. he basically wanted to imagine what the DNA molecule was like and what it was like to sort of break it apart. So he trained his brain to sort of hallucinate it.
What's his name?
Carrie Mullis. Won a Nobel Prize, but he didn't tell anyone how he'd done it until after he got the prize, obviously.
No. Carrie, what are you doing in there? Nothing. Working.
Actually made his own LSD as well. I mean, it's like total legend.
I'm assuming it was in the garage. It really feels like the kind of thing you do in the garage on a Friday night.
I mean, I think he was actually doing it in his lab. I think it was just, that was the kind of, the vibe he was.
I'm staying late again tonight. Are you all right? Yeah, I'm off my tits. I'm trying to imagine some cool stuff here.
So then in the mid-80s, we were sort of, obviously able to amplify DNA, start to use it, start to sort of, create more of it and produce vaccines, so recombinant vaccines. So we sort of worked on whooping cough, meningococcal meningitis, shingles. Those kinds of vaccines come through sort of genetic manipulation. And then all the way up to 1993 was when we sort of discovered the principles of CRISPR, that you could do, basically use what bacteria use to recognize DNA and to chop it up to start to really sort of, get more precision.
Sort of take a little section out and then replace it with something else.
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's way back in the 90s, actually.
I didn't realise it was that early.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we didn't start actually being able to do anything useful with that for a while, did we?
Not really until the sort of 2010s. Mm. And it won the 2020 Nobel Prize in chemistry. So, that feels really recent. And of course, everything that's happened in the last decade is mad with CRISPR, which is what we're going to get into. But you know, it's a long, long history. You know, we're talking sort of 60, 70 years, really, of work to get to this point where now we're faced with, you know, what obviously Matthew thinks of CRISPR as you know, a bit of a moral dilemma in ways.
And can I just quickly, just to be clear, CRISPR is a gene editing technique, ultimately.
Yeah. I'm not the expert on here, so I got Professor Matthew to talk us through it a bit more.
A whole series of people got very interested in this in the first years of this century, and this culminated in Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier in particular developing this technique called gene editing, whereby a single letter of DNA can be altered at will in any organism. So if you know the gene that you want to change, if you've got the gene sequence, and that you can deliver these various enzymes and bits of nucleic acid to the cell that's affected, then you can get the cell to say, oh, there's a change here. I'm going to use this bit of DNA that you've provided me with as a way of changing the DNA in the cell. So the key point here is that it's allegedly very, very precise. And secondly, it relies on really some very delicate understanding of the way that cells develop and divide. And that is different in different organisms and at different stages of the individual's life. And that's quite significant because this was discovered in 2012. It was applied to human cells in 2013, a few months later, and then basically has transformed science in the last 10 years. So in the last 10 years, basically, as I said, if you know the gene that you're interested in and you can get this, inject this stuff into an egg or into a particular cell, you can change that organism in whatever way you want. And this has been transformative for biology in general, so not just kind of medical applications or practical applications, but you know, something I'm interested in. People who are studying the sense of smell in ants were able to alter the smell, sense of smell in ants, and change their behavior and change their brain structure simply by changing a single gene. So it's provided an astonishing insight into the biology of all sorts of organisms.
Obviously, my little ears pricked up when I hear about the ants. So what's going on there?
This is a team from Rockefeller University in 2017. They published a paper saying they removed this single gene that plays a key part in odor reception in ants. It's called ORCO. And they deleted it using CRISPR-Cas9. So it got in there with the tool. The ants lost about 90% of their ability to smell. And they basically then, you know, so then you get all these roll-on effects. So this is what's interesting about this. So they basically weren't able to socialize because, you know, it, so much of it depends on the sense of smell. But they also changed in other ways. So like they laid very few eggs for reasons that aren't clear. They wandered aimlessly, like, you know, their purpose in life had just been taken away from them.
Well, presumably because they couldn't find their way anywhere.
I guess they find
their way through smell.
I guess that ostracizes them effectively.
Yeah.
And also they showed really sort of poor parenting, which you wouldn't necessarily associate with smell as such, but they were just weren't taking care of larvae and grubs in the same way. So I mean, it's sort of, this is the thing, like, you know, we talk about gene editing and obviously the DNA is you know, this series of chemicals effectively all linked together that each sort of one, each gene sort of encodes for a protein. And if you don't make that protein in the same way, then you just say, oh, you know, you don't have that protein. You've still got all the others. But that can have real knock-on effects. Like, you know, you don't have that protein now. And actually, you know, what you've done by altering the genome is had all these sort of unexpected, unanticipated effects that yeah, you just, you know, by taking out one gene, it can have a huge effect.
I was going to say, that's kind of a cautionary tale.
It should be.
About
I think
ants.
So, yeah.
Exactly what you were saying, where you're like, okay, there's no way that you would have been able to anticipate all of those behavioural effects.
No.
So if you do go in, you have to be aware that you might have, well, you will have unintended consequences.
Oh, yeah.
Unless you just sort of get lucky.
Well, you'd have to be really, really lucky.
Yeah, you don't really want to be taking that chance.
Especially because, I mean, it's not even a perfectly accurate tool, right? So you put the CRISPR-Cas9 into a cell or into an egg or whatever, and you hope it does the job that you think it's going to do because you've set it up to recognize a particular sequence of genes or whatever. But that's not, so you can't take it for granted that it'll just work in that way. And there are mistakes and there are sort of cuts that are made maybe in the wrong place.
Yeah.
So,
but love the idea of someone gene editing, a human embryo stem cells.
Let's get
just
to
sort
that.
Of crossing their fingers, like well.
But we're doing it with animals, right? So the big thing at the moment is gene editing in animals, and this is happening sort of all over the world, and for well motivated reasons, because as we know, scientists do things because they sit up and say, well, we could do this, we could do that, so let's give it a go. So one of the things is you edit a male sort of fertility gene effectively out of some really, really good stock. So out of some, like the bulls that you would use to sire a new generation. And you can put that into other bulls, knock out their sort of genes.
Yeah.
Put the bull gene in, from the one that you want. And then they're producing sperm basically from that prize bull. And then, you can just sire the sort of next generation of prize bulls without everyone having to have the prize bull. So it's like, oh, we can produce better livestock if we just, if we just basically take the elite animals. Use genetic engineering to put that in the qualities of the elite animals into all the other animals. And therefore, farming is better.
And not just farming. I immediately then think of like studs for horse racing.
Yeah, of course.
And how much money... Like good quality, horrible phrase, horse spunk goes for. Like it's insane. But if you could just say, well, no problem, I'm just going to take the relevant genes out of this very fast horse, and then suddenly all my rubbish slow horses are also producing this fantastic horse spunk.
Yeah, and they're sort of looking at themselves and saying, did I do that?
Yeah, it doesn't feel like me. This magnificent beast I've sired.
But I mean, interestingly, none of the scientists will have thought probably about the business model for that. But actually, that's going to be nobody's going to, how much are you going to charge for the genetics of your prize bull? I mean, the market is going to be
quite
big,
lot.
Isn't it? Yeah. So that's quite an interesting thing. That it's not just science, is it?
Interesting, because once it's gone, the market is sort of
flooded.
You're totally flooded, and then the price gets driven right down. So basically, someone can make a huge amount of money, and then it's just done.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. So that's sort of one example. I mean, in China, they're doing lots of stuff. So they're genetic,
of course,
no surprises. So they're sort of basically doing loads of CRISPR first. So they've got super fast aging monkeys, for instance. So you can study the genetics and the diseases of aging in these monkeys, because as soon as they're born, they start to die. That's basically.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I mean, which is obviously true of all of us, but this is mightily accelerated. Mm-hmm. So you can do that kind of thing, and they sort of mess around with dogs, mice, rats, pigs, rabbits. I mean, they're sort of doing all of it. Obviously,
it's a free for all. There's no sense of well, we shouldn't do it with these guys.
No. I mean,
it's just a sense of we should do it with anything we want. Yeah.
And the idea is that you get better quality meats, or you get disease-resistant livestock. Mm-hmm. But actually, when you look into the research that's going on in China, the things I've read say there's not really a lot of follow-up. So people are doing it's a bit of a Wild West sort of like, I wonder if we can do this, we can do that. And, we've done that. Let's do something else. And nobody's sort of going back and saying, yeah, but what did that actually achieve? Did it get us anywhere? So I mean, it's a bit more regulated, I think, over here and in Europe and in America. So progress sort of feels a bit slower, I guess. But we are moving
less regulated in America, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, but there's different things in America that you're allowed to do and not allowed to do. But and also, here we have the sense of, I'm not sure that people are really wanting to engage with the products of gene editing yet. So the idea is that you can, British geneticists will say, we can help our food and farming systems. And a lot of people are quite resistant to the idea of tinkering with what's, in their view, natural, I guess. So you could make things resistant to certain viruses. You can make agriculture more economically sort of viable, I guess, by, you know, reducing the need for antibiotics, say. But at the same time, people are sort of probably quite rightly a bit wary of like, yeah, but what else does that mean? You know, what else does that bring in?
Well, I mean, one thing that we do know, I think, fairly sort of uncontroversially, is that monoculture in agriculture is quite bad.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you're sort of engineering these disease-resistant crops, then they're all sort of genetically identical, and you're firing them in huge swathes, and it's quite bad for the,
they're vulnerable,
for the soil,
aren't they?
And also then vulnerable because they're all the same.
Yeah.
And, you know, genetic variation is actually a good thing,
yeah,
generally,
yeah,
in terms of viability.
So it's not a quick fix, basically. Or it might look like a quick fix.
Well, I think it might be just that. It might be a quick fix and then really bad news.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, Britain's starting to talk about, or the British government's starting to talk about opening up things a bit more, because we're, you know, historically quite resistant. And obviously, the EU has had a sort of no GMO sort of policy.
Yeah.
In America, they're as you say, they're a bit more gung-ho about it in the food chain. So you've got a thing called the AquaAdvantage salmon, which is genetically engineered to grow twice as fast as a normal salmon and to grow all year round.
Mm.
So like natural salmon, natural Atlantic salmon at least, grows in the spring and the summer while it's out at sea. And that's it. You know, it doesn't grow all year round, and it doesn't grow anywhere near as fast as this monster that they've got in America. But I'm not sure I'd eat it.
I mean, why not?
Something in me says, I don't want to be part of the experiment.
Yeah, I know. Look, I know what you mean. I think my concern is less about me eating it and more sort of about the welfare of the, like, how, what is the experience like for a salmon of growing twice as quickly,
yeah,
as it should? I mean, this is really dumb, but when you're a teenager and you're having growth spurts, it's really painful when you're growing a bit too quickly. I remember that.
You've got a height problem.
Is the salmon just having that for its entire life until it's then eaten?
I don't know if it hurts miserable. Salmon to grow. I mean, I genuinely don't know.
No, I don't know either.
But and it may be, I don't know. I mean,
it's worth thinking about.
The thing I thought about growing was that you lose coordination, don't you? You start to sort of lose your hand-eye coordination a bit. You're a bit sort of, you know, clumsy, effectively.
What?
When I was a teenager, I was clumsy. It was just like, I wasn't quite sure where all the bits of my body were.
You were an oaf. That's not generally true.
Is it not? Oh, I thought my experience spoke for everybody.
No, I think that's a universal experience.
No, it was just an oaf. Oh,
yeah,
fine.
I think so.
Okay, it all starts to make sense now. But that's the thing. Like, you know, you can engineer, you can imagine engineering so that animals feel less pain, say.
Yeah.
And then you'd say, oh, okay, so farming, you know, we can kind of farm how we like now because they don't really experience any pain. So you can imagine it sort of going in quite dark directions in some ways.
So that's really sort of bleak, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But also sort of justifiable. Like, why would you want an animal to go through pain? We can engineer that out.
Yeah. I think if I'm going down that route, I'm definitely much more interested in figuring out ways of just growing meat in a lab without it being an animal.
Yeah. Yeah,
that feels better. If I'm looking for pain-free, then that would be my route of choice.
Well, we'll just edit out the genes for consciousness.
So it is basically just a walking slab of meat. Yeah, yeah, great.
Yeah, yeah. Another sort of purported use for this is to de-extinct species.
Ah, yes. Now, I'm extremely interested in de-extinction, as you can imagine. But let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll get stuck into this idea of bringing animals back from extinction and how altering genomes of entire animal populations could help to defeat disease.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
And we're back. Now, Brooksy, I know we're not bringing dinosaurs back, but we might be able to bring some stuff back.
Yeah, like mammoths.
Yeah.
I mean, I always felt that they were sort of close enough to dinosaurs.
Yeah, it feels like the low-hanging fruit, really.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you can...
And they're not at all close to dinosaurs, it should be said.
No, they're really not. I mean, it's a terrible thought that actually... I'm pretty sure I had a Ladybird book about dinosaurs or something that had a mammoth on the front. Maybe I'm imagining that.
I hope you're imagining it.
Yeah, I must be. Because they were only...
Scientifically illiterate.
Yeah, they were literally only a few sort of tens of thousands of years ago.
Yeah, they're just sort of prehistoric, but, you know, recent prehistoric.
Yeah. Yeah,
they're not millions of years.
Anyway, we've got some of their DNA,
yeah.
So we can do genetic engineering with that, and you can basically pretty much build up the DNA. So you can either sequence it and just sort of work out what the DNA structure is, and then rebuild that in the lab, which is what George Church is doing, over in the States. He's at Harvard, and their sort of plan is to then sort of reconstruct that DNA, put it into the egg of an elephant. And then put the egg into an elephant, which carries the fertilized egg to gestation to birth, and then this elephant gives birth to a baby woolly mammoth. Kind of like to see that.
Yes, yeah, you would. But I mean, I feel like they've been, like George Church has been talking about this for a long time.
I think back in like 2016, he said, "Yeah, just give me a couple of years, guys."
I think he did.
And it hasn't happened yet.
Not materialised.
So, yeah, and maybe that's a good thing, because I'm not sure that the environment is ready for, you know, changing the sort of species that quickly.
No, and, you know, there's ethical considerations around whether you should be using an elephant when...
Yeah, and elephants aren't exactly numerous, are they?
Yeah, themselves.
Yeah,
no. But you're right. Of course, no one is saying no to... a woolly mammoth, really. But I still don't think it's quite on the table, is it?
I don't think it's on the table. And the other stuff that people want to bring back, sort of using similar techniques, it's sort of, you know, it's doable to a certain degree, but nobody can agree whether it's a good thing or not. So you can use CRISPR-Cas9, you know, all these sort of techniques for, you know, to put bits of old DNA into animals that, you know, basically can carry that kind of stuff. And so you can, you know, rebirth, say, the passenger pigeon or something like that and bring that back. But nobody's that bothered about that. So there has to be a sort of big payoff, really.
When they're talking about bringing back, trying to de-extinct the Tasmanian tiger.
Yeah.
Which is actually a very handsome, strange-looking. So it's a marsupial, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a stripy, like large.
Again, I want them
marsupial.
To do it, but I feel like they shouldn't.
But they, I mean, they literally didn't go extinct very long ago. They just got hunted to extinction, obviously.
Yeah.
I think. And that would be quite a fun one. And feels very doable because it's so.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's so recent.
Yeah.
And like I say, funny-looking things.
Yeah, so therefore...
Yeah, so...
yeah.
If you're funny-looking and you went extinct recently, I'm saying yes, please. Now, I could, as you know, very happily sit here and talk about the ethics of bringing animals back and which ones I'd like to bring back. But gene editing isn't limited to just animals by any means. Many scientists are concerned about changing human genes in order to cure stuff like genetic diseases.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, they're terribly worthy, aren't they? I mean, obviously, we want the Tasmanian tiger, and they want to cure things like sickle cell.
Sure, sure.
Fine, whatever. Sure. Yeah, I mean...
They're not mutually exclusive, guys.
So you've got these sort of various approaches you can use. So you can, in an individual's cells, take the cells and alter them and put them back in. You know, this is sort of somatic genetic engineering, so just doing the body. Or if you've got a heritable disease, you can actually change, you know, the eggs and the sperm so that it's no longer inherited. This germline, this is called germline editing. And that's much, much more controversial.
Yeah, because somatic editing is sort of going into the person and having a little fiddle. So it's sort of almost like you're treating the symptoms that are there. Whereas germline is kind of preventative. It's like you're never going to have this problem in the first place.
And your descendants won't have this problem either.
Yeah,
you inherited this problem. We can fix it now so that it's no longer a problem in your family line.
Yeah. Now the rest of the Edwards is huge balls. for example.
First in the queue.
And none of... Are any of these actually out on the market, so to speak?
Not really, no. These are all either hypothetical or sort of extremely experimental, you know, single-use things. And for good reason, because there's quite a lot of sort of concern about this, as Matthew told me.
There's been far greater concern, and I think absolute outrage, in fact, over the potential to alter the next generation. In other words, to cure genetic diseases before the individual is even born, before it's even conceived. And in 2018, this actually happened in China, where a Chinese researcher called He Zhongqi carried out an experiment on, at the time, it was said to be two individuals, two baby girls. Turned out there's a third girl who was also born later on. And these were altering all their genes, not just their cells in their blood or anything like that. So it was done as a part of an IVF procedure. And this was done for, well, frankly, no good reason. The experiment he was planning to do was pointless. There was no medical need for it. And it didn't do what he said it was going to do. And what happened, as far as we know, is that the genes of the girls were altered in ways we have not seen in any other individuals anywhere on the planet. So CRISPR, despite being a pair of scissors, turns out not to be quite so precise. So this metaphor of a scalpel or scissors is not right. And this revealed two things. Firstly, that the procedure was much less precise than we thought. Secondly, the absolutely fundamental thing is, why on earth would you wish to do such a thing? Because It's now been accepted that the only people who would actually benefit from this are couples who both have the same genetic disease in the same number of copies who want to have a biological child. And we don't know how many such people there are around the world, but estimates range in the low hundreds.
Yeah, I suppose actually that's the thing we should have been really clear about, the difference between somatic changes and germline changes, is that germline changes mean that you've altered the genetic makeup of every single cell in the resulting body, whereas somatic, that's not the case.
Yeah.
And also doing it in a somatic way doesn't mean anything about their heritability.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So germline is a much more sort of serious operation.
So where are we going to go if we want to do such a thing?
Let me have a little think. I do remember is he called Her John Key?
Yeah, Her John Key, I think.
Her John Key.
Yeah.
And it was, not brilliant. But I did sort of assume that was a fairly isolated example. I don't know if I assumed it. I think I just hoped it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of isolated. And he's like absolutely the fall guy for this. But he had collaborators who maybe didn't know as much. And there were people sort of under investigation in the States as well that he collaborated with who nobody's quite sure how much they knew. And there's sort of question marks over whether people sort of just turned a blind eye to what he was doing. But he was, everyone says, he was like massively naive and massively ambitious and wanted to do something that, put him on the map sort of thing. And so he falsified all kinds of documents. He didn't tell the parents to be about any risks or about, the full risk. He basically didn't do the proper safety testing. He broke the law broke multiple laws. It was...
He has put himself on the map.
Yeah, he's certainly done that. Yeah. And he's out of prison now. So,
who knows what he's up to?
He came out in April. I mean, scientists who get punished for this kind of thing, they never stay in prison for long, funnily enough.
No, but, and he's going to be in a nice white-collar prison.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, for sure. So he's had to do some time. Bit of a fall guy, I think, for the whole program.
Sure.
In some ways. And it's really interesting. So what he did was effectively genetically alter those, or try to genetically alter those children, two of them at least, we don't know about the third, so that they were resistant to HIV. Mm. And they were their fathers, or the sperm donors for the IVF embryos, were HIV positive, which meant that those people couldn't take part in any IVF anyway. So they were sort of excluded. So he kind of exploited their desperation.
Yeah.
So these couples who were desperate to have children couldn't have them, couldn't join the IVF program because the father was HIV positive. So he definitely sort of exploited that desperation, which is a thing we've seen in other genetics. Like there's a Korean guy who exploited sort of women and took their eggs without them knowing or without permission and stuff like that. Geneticists are not,
whiter than white.
Not whiter than white, really. Mm. And maybe that's just a function of, if you want to work in this area, you've got to have a certain gung-ho sort of attitude.
But it is different in the UK because our laws are pretty strict on this, aren't they?
It is. And one of the things that's come out in the last few months is that people looking at the documents and the sort of safety protocols and the protocols about the experiment say there's really something fishy about that Chinese experiment, where it looks like there may have been government officials who turned a blind eye, because what we were saying about the side effects of these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So the alteration in the CCR5 gene, which brings that kind of HIV resistance, has also been shown to enhance cognition and memory, and basically make or purport to possibly make a child more intelligent. So, so you start to think, maybe people were sort of thinking, if he does this and if it turns out to be, kind of good for improving a child's sort of cognitive abilities, maybe we'll forgive him for his... So who knows what's happened to those children
mucky,
now?
It's mucky, isn't it?
It is mucky.
Really mucky.
Yeah, because that does bring you into the idea of sort of designer babies. Mm. So far, that link between the gene and intelligence is only suggestive. And that may have been what he was trying to do. actually, rather than the HIV stuff. But we just don't know enough, you know, and you can't do that in the UK, as you say. You know, you can't manipulate embryos beyond just a few days. And you need to be able to really sort of justify why you're doing it if you do it.
That, yeah, because it has been done, hasn't it?
There was this idea that, you know, you can engineer an embryo just to try and sort of get some sort of understanding of what might be going on there with pregnancy loss. And what they found actually is there's the pregnancy loss is associated with, and that's all you can say with genetics, it's like not caused by, but it's associated with an altered perception of male odors and differences in brain regions that process smells. So again, it's like another one of these like side effects you'd never have seen coming. Yeah. So, and that's the thing. So you get these sort of strange links between genetic alterations and, you know, things that show up that you just can't imagine how.
So is that saying then that if a pregnant woman was to notice that she was, her perception of male smells was changing, that would be an alarm bell?
Was different, maybe was different from how she perceived others to be. I'm not sure whether it's sort of altered all the time, or if you have a slightly different smell perception,
yeah,
you're more likely to suffer repeated pregnancy loss.
It's a good example where it's just incredibly
complicated.
It's incredibly complicated. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but you know, so you get things like, you know, to go back a bit more basic. So if you alter rabbits to be leaner, you find out they just get longer tongues as well as being leaner. You know, their tongues stick out of their mouths. You know, it's just sort of bizarre stuff. So, and there were cattle that were tweaked to have no horns.
Mm-hmm.
Then actually, you know, which is a kind of a useful thing because part of the farming process in a lot of cases is to remove the horns.
Yeah.
But actually, these cattle were found, and they had a long stretch of bacterial DNA in their genomes, which conferred some antibiotic resistance to them, weirdly. So it's like, oh, did not see that coming.
Yeah, I mean, this entire discussion can be summed up with unintended consequences. That's the thing. We were not expecting that.
Yeah, people at the Crick Institute basically said that they analysed data from previous experiments with CRISPR-Cas9. They found about 16% of the engineered organisms had accidental mutations.
So that really is telling you, leave it alone, isn't it?
It's sort of telling me that, or that we're not good enough yet to certainly take this out and really
that's what I mean. I don't mean leave it alone, because I think that the applications are potentially sort of quite revolutionary, but don't rush it. I suppose that's it.
Yeah, don't
figure out what's going on.
So whoa. Okay, stop, think. I mean, it's basically like crossing the road, isn't it? Look both ways.
That way there's some cars, this way. Oh, there's a herd of wildebeest, wasn't expecting that. So I suppose, given that we're asking what geneticists will do next, I want to feel slightly more comfortable about how sort of responsible and trustworthy they are.
I mean, they don't have a great track record. I mean, most of them, I'm sure 99% are absolutely fine.
Yeah, but 1%.
They've got the rogue elements there. And Matthew's quite concerned about things like that, particularly when it comes to something called gene drives.
So gene drives are basically a piece of DNA that copies itself furiously from generation to generation. And this is an idea that was developed at the beginning of the century in order to think about how could we transform pest populations, like, for example, mosquitoes. How could we either eradicate them from a local area, make them sterile, or make them resistant to malaria so they couldn't transmit it? And basically, this is a bit like a genetic bomb. Once you let it go, you can't get it back, and this thing will just kind of copy itself madly. Now, none of these things have been released. They have been built in the laboratory in a couple of places and tested in kind of large cages, but none have been let out because people, the scientists themselves, are so concerned about what might happen. Now, here we get to the issue of who should decide. So let's say that you are in a village in Burkina Faso, which is one of the places that's been studied for this, where you have very high levels of malaria. And 500,000 people a year die from malaria, most of them children under 5. That's with all the bed nets and the DDT and all the rest of it. We are still losing 500,000 people a year. So I can quite imagine if I was a parent in a village in Burkina Faso, I would be very keen to have this system released so I could get rid of the mosquitoes and my children would have a chance of surviving. But firstly, you've got to explain to people what you're doing. They have to be informed. They have to provide what's called informed consent. And where you've got populations that are partly or often entirely illiterate, they may not even have a word for gene in their language. How do you explain what you're planning to do?
Well, the phrase that immediately set the alarm bells going for me there was the scientists themselves are concerned. I feel like we spend quite a lot of time in different episodes talking about this exact dilemma, which is who decides. So we talked about it in our geoengineering episode. We talked about it in our endangered animals episode. It just keeps coming up. And it is key to everything, isn't it?
It is. And you know, scientists definitely don't want to be the like, oh, we've done this thing for you. We'll just, you know, hand it over and it'll all be fine. Because they know it won't be. But they also know that there's a possibility it'll do some good. And they want to, you know, give it with informed consent, I guess. But yeah, that's so hard to do, as you're saying. Yeah, so you know, I don't know how you sort of get across the sort of political and ethical issues. So like gene drives, these things, you know, which he described like releasing a bomb, basically. Mm. I mean, they're great in that, you know, if you do it in a population of mosquitoes, and you can do it in just the mosquitoes that carry malaria, mm-hmm. and you can, say, reduce the population of females so that all of the successful progeny are male, and all of a sudden you've got a population of entirely male mosquitoes that can't go anywhere, can't continue to breed, so the population collapses. So it's a really, you know, clever idea. And there's things you can do with like invasive rodent species, feral cats, you know, but people in Edinburgh are researching how you might control grey squirrels, which are an invasive species, mm-hmm. And using this sort of gene drive technology. But, you know, what we, as with all of this stuff, unintended consequences. So you can, I mean, A, cause sort of a disruption in the ecosystem. You could get uncontrollable spread of this genetic alteration. So it'll cross, say, national boundaries.
Mm.
So one parliament, you know, approves it. So the English parliament approves it, spreads into Scotland. The Scottish parliament's got no choice but just to accept it. Mm. You know, is that okay? There's sort of legal issues there. You get mutations. So you get the thing that you've changed within the thing can cause mutations in other areas of the genome. So yeah. Again, unintended consequences.
Yeah,
there.
Like these mosquitoes are massive. And really sort of sexually frustrated and quite angry.
And you can actually have modified animals that will actually develop mutations that neutralize the modification as well, because you know nature finds a way. That's the kind of
it's gonna sort of fight back.
Yeah So that's not a great thing.
Also, there's the obvious point, which I think is that with gray squirrels, so that's an invasive species, so you kind of know what it'll be like without them because that's what it used to be like.
Yeah,
but with mosquitoes carrying malaria, they're native to the area, and so wiping them out, you don't know what the knock-on is going to be. Like what? So I'm just speculating here. But what feeds on mosquitoes?
Well, birds.
Yeah,
for instance.
Birds. So what's the impact going to be on the, you know, certain bird populations? What were that like? It has a sort of a ripple effect that you have to think about.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying that, you know, some bird populations in decline is going to outweigh saving 500,000 lives. But you've got to think about it.
Yeah, yeah. And also, if you wipe out that particular species of mosquito, you'll get invasions of other species that might not carry malaria yet, but who knows whether they'll evolve so freely that they might evolve other problems.
That's the thing. Mm-hmm. You're leaving it open a niche for another, probably another mosquito to populate.
Yeah.
Hmm. This is making me worry quite a lot, this episode. I thought it probably would. And so let me just ask a quick conspiracy theorist style question, if I may. We obviously hear quite a lot about biological warfare, synthetic lab-made pandemics. Is there any truth to any of that kind of fear?
I mean, I'd love to say no.
Oh.
But, I mean, Matthew has some interesting things to say about the potential of lab leaks.
I'm going to preface everything that I'm going to say with the statement that all the evidence we have is that COVID-19 is a naturally occurring spillover event. That is, that it is a disease that originated almost certainly in bats and was transmitted to humans. The latest evidence suggests in two very close together waves in the famous market in Wuhan in China. But that does not mean to say that it is not impossible that either a lab leak, so a leak from a laboratory of somebody cultivating a particular virus, or from doing what are called gain of function studies. So these are experiments that became very fashionable at the beginning of this century, following 9/11. So the American government in particular became extremely exercised about the prospect of terrorists acquiring biological weapons. And this is something that they'd been concerned about for decades, initially with regard to the Soviet Union. And quite rightly too, because it turns out that the Soviet Union was developing very dangerous new biological weapons using these techniques of genetic recombination. So in order to try and understand this process and also to respond to the growing conviction that we were heading for a pandemic, because in 2002 there was the first SARS outbreak, which was kind of like a dress rehearsal for COVID, and we didn't pay attention. And then there was another outbreak of something called MERS, which killed about 800 people in the Middle East. And again, we weren't paying attention to that. But the epidemiologists and the virologists were, and they were trying to predict what would be the course of change, of natural mutation of a particular set of viruses. And so they started doing what are called gain of function studies. That is deliberately making the viruses more transmissible or more lethal in their effects. Now you might say, that seems utterly bonkers. Why would anybody want to do that? And I'm inclined to agree. Now, the argument they gave was, well, this will help us predict the course of future pandemics. And I'm afraid the last 2.5 years have shown that they didn't.
One of my favourite things, I think, is when our experts, before they give an answer, they offer a massive caveat and then a big... But
now hear what I'm saying, yeah, and not what, yeah, I'm not saying.
Yeah, take this with a pinch of salt, but this is going to get spicy. But he's basically right, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, we know this, don't we? Because we've talked about this before. Like you get these sort of ideas of like, I wonder if, or maybe we should that, and then all of a sudden you find yourself in a research program where you're like, oh, shit, I hope this doesn't get out of the lab.
Yeah.
Because it's like there were the Dutch bird flu researchers who wanted to know whether you could aerosolize bird flu. Because at the moment, it's quite hard to transmit. Mm. But they're saying, you know, maybe there's like genetic changes that would allow it to just sort of be transmitted in the air, effectively through like duck sneezes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so they did it. And they sort of like, oh, this is what you'd need to do. Or this is what evolution would need to do. Or this is what a terrorist would need to do in order to, you know, aerosolize this bird flu. And then they kicked up a real stink when nobody allowed them to publish it. Mm. So people were saying, guys, maybe don't put that in the literature.
Yeah, we'll leave that one, actually. It's all a bit like the plot of Mission Impossible 2.
So and there are leaks from labs. So like obviously scientists keep things like anthrax and smallpox in labs, and they work on them to try and sort of work out, I guess, you know, preventative measures.
I get that.
But scientists are not great at keeping these things under control. So 2014, which wasn't that long ago, right, 75 scientists at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention were exposed to anthrax, like just because of, you know, I guess, you know, some kind of scientific administrative error. And then just a few weeks after that, the FDA in America, the officials ran across 16 forgotten vials of smallpox, just like sitting in the fridge.
And what's in these?
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so, but often they don't even... I've definitely read before about the sort of security levels, and quite often some of this stuff is not kept in the highest security facilities.
I mean, it's quite bad. So, like, in China, there was people working on the SARS virus, and that got out, and... basically because they managed to infect themselves with it. So it wasn't a leak from the lab as such, but during the process of research, they got infected with SARS, didn't know, just went home, and seven other people got SARS from that, including the main guy's mother, who died. So, so I think, you know, you'd have to argue that yes, this stuff is interesting and potentially useful, but let's be careful.
Yeah. Okay, so the question we're asking, what will geneticists do next? I mean, all sorts.
Yeah, I mean, normally we go for a yes, no.
Yeah.
Sort of thing, but here it's just like...
Almost anything you can think of, someone's having a crack.
Here's what Matthew had to say.
I've got to get over both the excitement. So what genetics is going to do next is carry on discovering fundamental things about how life works, how it came to be, and it's also going to enable us, if we think these powers can be used safely and accurately, to cure diseases, to create new crops, for example, ways of enabling plants to deal with climate change, to deal with dehydration, to deal with drought, to even introduce different forms of photosynthesis, because not all plants use the same forms of photosynthesis. Some forms are much more effective than others. We might be able to increase CO2 uptake in certain plants by transferring their carbon dioxide processing mechanisms, photosynthetic mechanisms, from one species to another. That's the kind of thing we can do. So I think there's astonishing times for discovery, for practical applications, including in agriculture and for medicine. But the absolute precondition is that all this is done safely, ethically, with an awareness of the potential consequences, because you want to meet the bad consequences before they happen. You want to stop them happening, not meet them after it's too late.
Amen.
Well, I'm guessing that, you know, that's the point of his book, isn't it? Is to say, guys, it's great, it's all really good.
A lot of potential here.
Yeah, but let's look at the history and learn from it, hopefully.
Let's just be a little bit careful. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he sort of sounds optimistic. I'm not convinced that the optimism bears out, really.
Optimistic. I suppose I'm optimistic in the sense that great things will come out of this.
Yes.
I think some bad stuff will also come out of it.
Yeah, I think the bad stuff will almost happen first before we get to the good stuff.
Mm.
That's sort of my problem with it. It's like, I don't know how you fix that, because I think that's just human. It's almost like the flaw in science, isn't it? Is that the quick and easy stuff is usually negative, and the hard and really positive stuff, it takes longer and a lot more care. But it's worth it in the end, I guess.
Yeah, you think so.
Except for those fat salmon.
Those poor fat salmon. Although it has made me think about sushi.
Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Professor Matthew Cobb. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. You can also find us on Twitter at EurekaPod. We also really love hearing from you guys. So if you have any burning questions you want answering, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london. That's stak.london. Or you can always find us on Twitter at EurekaPod. Thanks.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.